Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
In the Indo-Pacific, the preparation is for war with the People's Republic of China, the first island chain. In the Black Sea, the war is underway, Ukraine versus the Russian Black Sea Fleet. Along the NATO frontier, the expectation is, now we're told, a triple joint nuclear strike by North Korea, China, and Russia. In other words, war, 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 underway, certainly in the Middle East, underway in Ukraine, and threatened in East Asia, even threatened between Tehran and Jerusalem. What is to be done? I welcome Brenda Schaefer, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, who has a story called Operational Energy that reminds all of us, you don't go to war unless you have an energy resource that you can count on. The book is by Alan Howard, Daniel Nussbaum, and Brenda Schaefer, the authors. Brenda, a very good evening to you. Not only do you need the energy source, you need to secure the energy source. And as I understand, you need to look at your adversary's energy source. Let's measure how that is doing right now in wars underway. I'm looking at Ukraine. What is your assessment of the two adversaries, Russia and Ukraine? Are they attending to their energy sources? What can they do? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Yeah, I mean, energy has played an important role throughout history in the outcome of all battles and all wars, especially evident if you look at almost every battle in World War II. They were either they were determined by the lack of energy, or they were determined by the goal to reach energy. For instance, Hitler's Operation Edelweiss, when he tried to reach the oil fields of Baku and did fighting two battles at once, Stalingrad and trying to get to Azerbaijan, Soviet Azerbaijan at the time, to Baku, just to get the oil. He was willing to risk Stalingrad and maybe even lost Stalingrad because he was fighting two battles at once. So energy is highly determines the outcomes of battles and wars. Yet this is the first book to date published on the topic of operational energy, together with two colleagues of mine from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, Dr. Daniel Nussbaum and Alan Howard. And it's good you asked about Ukraine, and I could say also the Israel-Gaza war, that there's an energy element here that's quite evident. And if you look at for instance, Ukraine and Russia, prior to the recent escalation, they were planning on having negotiations in Qatar, in Doha, and they were going to focus only on keeping energy infrastructure outside of the battles between them, you know, agreeing that Russia wouldn't attack the nuclear power plant and Ukraine wouldn't attack the, you know, refineries and other oil storage. So it was just an illustration of how important to both sides energy was so far in this war.
And securing your energy source before you go to war, it occurs to me that I have not been looking at the Ukraine map correctly. I need to look at it in terms of supply lines of energy, or even the most recent, the Kursk salient, where the Ukrainians have committed four or five brigades running on fuel to advance or to maintain their resources. They have to maintain their supply lines. You also make the case in the book, I believe. I'm looking forward to talking to you and your authors at length about it, that you need to concern yourself with your adversary's supply line. And that would explain why Ukraine has used drones against the Russian refineries. You would think that Russia, as vast as it is, with as much natural gas and oil as it has, one or two refineries taken down because they need to be serviced after the attack would not be profound. But I believe it is. I think that Russia has stopped exporting refined petroleum products entirely because of damage to their refineries. I think that's correct. So even Russia, as vast as it is vulnerable to attacks on its infrastructure. Is that something that modern military people take into account when they go to war?
Sure. So operational energy, as you said correctly, it has two elements. One is providing energy to your forces to run your military operations, but it's also disrupting the enemy's military supplies. This was very basic. If you go back to wars, literally over thousands of years, military planners thought of this. But actually, in the current wars, both Ukraine and then also Israel in the context of Gaza have been held back by the United States at certain periods from disrupting the energy supply. So the initial months of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Washington held Kyiv back from attacking Russian oil installations and other energy installations because they were afraid that this could jack up the global oil price, you know, before the midterms, you know, at a time that was important to the United States. In the case of Gaza, not only is Israel being restrained from disrupting the energy supplies to Hamas, it actually has to supply them themselves. It's actually supplying the fuel. I mean, could you imagine during World War II, someone stopping the U.S. and saying, you know, the German people need power. They need electricity. Please, United States, provide some fuel to Berlin, to Stuttgart. They need some energy. It's almost an impossible way to fight a war. But certainly the Israel-Gaza war has become much longer, lasted much more months than it could have been finished because Israel's been providing fuel to Hamas, which sustains the terror tunnels, which allows Hamas to sustain the war. So we really have almost traditional strategies, you know, turned on its head. The United States, for most of the 20th century, early 21st century, it benefited from, one, having, you know, very ample, rich domestic energy supplies, you know, for the home front, but also the ability to supply this for their own war fighting and for their allies, undisrupted, right? So they could have supply lines into Europe and, you know, and eventually, you know, into the Asian theater and get energy there. Future wars of the United States already, American adversaries are going to disrupt energy supply. So the United States has a whole new challenge in dealing with supplying its forces. And you see this in the book. When you read Russian, Chinese, and Iranian doctrine, they understand, well, you know, tank to tank or plane to plane, we can't beat the Americans. But what we can do is, you know, undermine their energy supplies, disrupt their communications, all the aspects of asymmetric warfare. And another thing they all talk about, and we see this already in the case of Ukraine, Israel, is hybrid warfare, which means you bring the domestic front into the war. So all of the U.S. adversaries are thinking about disrupting, you know, electricity supplies in the United States, turning out the lights at major events, major cities. And I think that will be a big part of future war fighting for the United States. And it's not clear we're at all prepared for that.
It's long been a remark about Pearl Harbor that what the Japanese fleet did not do, the first thing is, the carriers weren't there. They were unlucky. The carriers were out. If they'd sunk those carriers, the war would have been over. No, what the Japanese did not do is hit the petroleum fields. The fuel for the fleet was sitting right there, and a second wave would have taken it down. So as early as 1941, the U.S. was not thinking of protecting its fuel sources. Brenda, a thought about the book, Operational Energy. Is this something that is already understood at the Pentagon and at NATO about maintaining and protecting the supply? Or would this be new to them?
I want to go back to your point about the fuel supplies in Hawaii. Do you know the name of the specific facility that could, if it would have been hit, would have greatly affected the U.S. war effort.
Well, All I know is Hickam Field. I don't know more than that.
Right. So it's called Red Hill. And actually, no enemy of the United States closed it down. Actually, the United States military itself, the Secretary of Defense closed it down in 2021 due to environmental concerns. So not only because of that closure, which there's been no replacement for, but if you look, and we have this a map in the book, if you look at if the U.S. needs to enter the European theater, it has, NATO countries that have dedicated fuel that they would provide to the United States. You have the Central European pipeline system that would provide, that's, dedicated to provide fuel for military operations. But if we were to act in Asia, we don't have any dedicated infrastructure. We don't have the same treaty relationships with allies and partners. And also most of American allies and partners in Asia are not physically connected. So even if you had some fuel in Japan, you couldn't necessarily get it to Taiwan or to South Korea. So from a fuel perspective, Asia is a much bigger challenge to the United States to protect, to engage in warfare than Europe is. Sure, of course, I think the military leadership is thinking about this unquestionably. I think there is, I think in many cases, over time, it's not, not just this administration, but in Europe and as well as the United States, there's a disconnect between some of the climate and energy policies of the civilian leadership versus what militaries can do. For instance, the U.S. military is the largest consumer of energy in the United States. So obviously, if you want to make an energy transition to renewable energy, the first place you're going to look is the military. But actually, the military is the last place that can actually use renewable energy, because the military needs very dense fuels, which means for every bit of weight or mass, how packed that is with a lot of energy. Renewable energy is very, it's not dense. It's very low density. Fossil fuels are very high density, and that's what you need to run ships and planes.
Brenda Schaefer of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, with her colleagues Alan Howard and Daniel Nussbaum. The book is Operational Energy. We're going to Baku, however, afterwards, because the energy fields of the Caspian Sea are vital not only to Central Asia, but also to Europe, thanks to the Southern Gas Pipeline. And upcoming is COP29 at Baku. What is the thinking in the Caspian Sea Basin now about energy needs in the future? And, of course, concerns about climate change. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Hey, guys. Finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Gold Belly. Gold Belly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Gold Belly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.